it really plays in. And I think you, it gives you the opportunity to be creative, create something that's your own, and really stand out from the competition to charge as much as your market will allow. And I think that's the cool piece, is not only do you get the creativity and the freedom to do it how you want, but I think on the back end, that translates into you being able to charge what you want as well, as long as your value meets the experience you're giving.
You're listening to the Active Duty Passive Income Podcast, the number one resource for active duty veterans and their families who want to learn how to build real wealth through real estate investing. Each week, we sit down with top military real estate investors, industry experts, and leaders who share their secrets to success in the real estate game. Now,
get off your ass,
get motivated, and take action to make your financial freedom dreams a reality.
Before we get started with today's show, I have to let my faithful ADPI podcast family in on a little secret. For the past year, we've been hard at work trying to consolidate all of our Epic resources into one community-based platform to damn near guarantee our member success. I'm proud to announce the launch of ADPI Campus, our off-Facebook, all-in-one platform dedicated to helping the military community own more of the land they swore to protect and defend. From networking to live workshops to courses, masterminds, cohorts, and even one-on-one coaching, ADPI Campus is the community for military real estate investors worldwide. Sign up for your free trial of ADPI Campus at www.adpicampus.com, where you'll get complete access to our brand new bootcamp mini course and our exclusive deal room, where you can list, connect, buy, and sell deals alongside other military real estate investors. That's www.adpicampus.com to sign up now for free. Do it now before it's too late. Now, let's start the show. Hey, what's going on, ADPI Nation? Kevin Brenner here, host of the Active Duty Passive Income Podcast, still gallivanting Europe. You know, if you're listening to this podcast and you're wondering why I haven't been as consistent as I have been, or maybe you're a first-time listener, we'll not talk about it. But the point is, I'm taking a little hiatus and living in Europe and making it happen. But my guest here today is super, super exciting, a friend of mine, and we're going to talk about something that we really haven't talked about on the show in over 340 episodes, and that is boutique hotels. So a lot of you might know my story and how my wife designs hotels. If you've been through our military short-term rental academy, you saw all the lessons where my wife was teaching you how to design hotels and Airbnbs and all of that stuff. Blake kind of has a similar story, but he scaled massively and he focused on one asset class, and he's going to show us how you guys can follow in his footsteps. And we're going to talk about different pathways, different roadblocks, and really just really dig into the asset class that is boutique hotels and why it could be something attractive to look into, especially if you already have short-term rentals and you want to scale in that direction. But Blake Daly, man, welcome to the show.
What's up, man? Good to be here. I'm sorry I'm boring. I am in the US of A, not gallivanting Europe. So coming from a little bit more boring background in Utah right now. But yeah, man, super excited for the show. Dig into boutique hotels. Love this asset class. I think it's really on the come up. And like I've just seen personally, like the power of going from short-term rentals to boutique hotels. So maybe I can sway some people today looking at bigger deals.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and that's what we talk about in kind of making that jump from residential real estate investing to commercial real estate investing. And really, this is the kind of the same thing, except what we're talking about is kind of going from short-term rentals, which is residential hospitality, if you will, and commercializing it and putting it under one roof, one property, just, you know, really factoring in those economies of scale to make something really, really cool. So let's talk briefly, dude. Just hit me with your kind of military background and how you got started in real estate investing.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely got to come back to that scalability, because that's probably the biggest piece of this whole thing. But I got my start doing the very unscalable, at least in my opinion, portion of this. We're buying, renovating, and renting out on Airbnb these hurricane damaged homes in Panama City. That was my first duty location. I was an Air Force officer down there, got there right after a Category 5 hurricane wiped through. In retrospect, like, it was a pretty good place to start investing, because I could get a lot of distressed properties. Driving for dollars was very easy to do, because you could see the holes in the roofs, right? You could see the overgrown lawns, everything blown from the wind of the hurricane. So it was really easy to bootstrap it and get good leads early on. But when I first got there, I was like, oh my God, what did the Air Force send me to? But it was a kind of a good place to start out. And we did that for that first year, finding some of these leads. I wholesaled some of them, did one flip with a partner, and the rest were BRRRs that I was holding on to. So I was doing the flips and the wholesales to build up my own personal cash, because I had like $2,000, $2,500 coming out of the Air Force Academy to buy a house. So thankfully, there's this thing called the VA loan where I could put zero down and use that $2,000 to furnish the house, and we put it on Airbnb. And in that first year, we bought like 13 units and surpassed my like W-2 income as an Air Force officer with the cash flow from all the real estate that we'd bought in that first year. So that kind of got my wheels turning. I was like, man, I need to go bigger. Like I was like, obviously my goals were a little bit too small. If, you know, my goal and my 5-year Air Force commitment was to replace my cash flow, I did it in the first year. So that got me into the commercial side. And I had just seen, you know, being like the owner operator of running around to all these different houses. So it really appealed to me to have one building with more units, you know, and get the economies of scale, like you mentioned, which is absolutely the case and makes managing much, much easier, especially at the scale we're at now.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, talking about getting all of this figured out while you're at your first duty station, I mean, where did you first decide that, you know, real estate investing, like you're coming out of the academy, it's not like they taught you real estate investing there. Do you have a background in it in your family? Did you just have this urge to just try it? What's the circumstance with the hurricane?
No background or real exposure in anything. I think my mom was a lifelong renter, single mom. So we rented places, moved pretty often, and didn't really have exposure to real estate. I did take business classes in high school, and that's what first got me onto it. So I was like, I knew I wanted to get into business, be some sort of entrepreneur, run some kind of business. I just didn't know what yet. And through kind of that discovery at the academy, read books, I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, found Bigger Pockets, read the Brandon Turner books, and kind of learned at least the very basics to be, you know, as a newbie, dangerous enough to go find a property and try to house hack it with a VA loan, which is very low risk because you got to find a place to live anywhere. With the VA loan, you're putting zero down. When you're house hacking with the VA loan, you are, you know, potentially we lived for free for a house that we got for no money. So it's just a great way to kind of break down the barriers and like get in that first deal. And I think that was the momentum, is like, we saw that we could do this, and like, we made like $100 or something like that net cash flow on that house hack because of Airbnb. Like after the Wi-Fi, after the utilities, after everything, we were making money to live for free. And I was like, oh shoot, I think we're onto something here, and just leaned into it.
Now, was this like a duplex, triplex, quadplex situation on this house hack? Or were you like renting out rooms in your house? Like what kind of sacrifice were you making?
It was actually, we actually did try renting the room, and that lasted for like 2 months with my wife. And she's like, we can't do it anymore.
No.
We're newly married. I mean, we got married in June, bought the house in July, and had like our first like room rented in August or whatever. And she was like, yeah, we're not doing this by September. And I was like, all right, fair enough. You know, the first couple months of marriage are the most walking on eggshells. So I got to make her happy. But it turned out really well. But it was actually a main house with a mother-in-law suite. So like a guest unit, it could be an ADU,
above garage, whatever,
apartment. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. A basement unit that you convert. So that's what we have done. We've like built that little strategy and have made like almost, I think, $1 million in equity now from just main houses with guest houses.
Yeah.
So that is something that we lean into because we saw that we were net cash flowing on just the guest house. We found another house in our area that had a house with a guest house and a pool in the middle. I was like, oh, that should do even better because we're in Florida. Weather's awesome. We're close to the beach and it has a pool. That thing's going to crush. And we know already, because the same size, same setup, that the guest house will pay all the expenses. So the main house is essentially going to be all profit. So we just kept looking for houses like that. And when I was driving for dollars, finding my own leads, like I was specifically targeting these houses with guest houses. We've used VA loans on two of them. We used low down loans on other ones, seller financing, for sale by owner with private money, and did a BRRRR on that one. So just kind of any way we could get into these houses that we found that were working really well for us. And that got us to the point where like, okay, shoot, now it's kind of a lot, right? I'm full-time in the Air Force, still learning how to be an Air Force officer, learning my job at the time, new to being active duty. Not only that, I'm learning how to be a real estate investor, how to be an operator, how to manage and run our Airbnbs and do the marketing and the listing optimization and manage guests, right? Like I'm sitting in the Air Force office and getting hounded by guests of like, oh, the toilet's clogged or, you know, whatever. We've got see bugs in the unit and then I've got to figure out how to deal with that. And was going to run around all these different houses. And then once we got to that point of, okay, now we've got enough cash flow, like our expenses are taken care of. Like now we can take some bigger risks because we know we can do this. And then that pushed us into the commercial side, doing the same thing with now looking for hotels where we can get more units with one purchase. And now it's commercial real estate, not residential real estate. Mm-hmm. So as we increase the income, right, the net operating income is what determines your value. So as we're increasing the NOI of these properties, we're not limited by the comps because it's right. commercial. So now we're able to force the value of these properties like crazy. And just by throwing them on, you know, booking.com and Airbnb and getting them the listing distribution, we're essentially doubling the revenue of these properties. So it was pretty good strategy we found early on.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the crazy thing. It's the great thing that the short-term rental industry in its nature, because it disrupted hospitality to a point. And I remember having a meeting. I was part of the kind of business advisory council in Savannah when I was stationed there, and they kind of like accepted me on their council because I was like a military officer, and they probably just wanted like a military guy on there. I had no business being there.
Well,
I was
yeah,
with like some of the top business people in Savannah. I was sitting around this table, but there were hoteliers there. You know, Savannah's a big hotel destination. Mm-hmm. And this was back in 2019, something like that, 2018, 2019. And I asked one of the biggest hoteliers in Savannah, I was like, what do you think about Airbnb and short-term rentals? And do you think that's going to have a disruption to you? And he looked at me and he said, no. He said, because he's like, the only thing it's going to disrupt is the online space in how people, he's like, because the people who want to stay at my hotel, they're just older people. They don't use the internet. He's like, the people that are going to stay at an Airbnb are going to use the internet and use technology. And because of that, because the operators, at least that's how I feel, because the operators are kind of younger in our generation, the technology has advanced with them. And technology and the short-term rental industry has embraced technology more than traditional hospitality has. And because of 100%. That, it's created so many efficiencies and you're able to scale a business remotely and make something happen that way. Where in the traditional hospitality space, you know, you know, they were just kind of just figuring out like a booking website, you know, and like using online travel agencies and stuff like that. But yeah, that's like...
Dude, that's so prevalent. Like the tech adoption in the space is what led so much to the growth of it. Like people, you know, just hearing about Airbnb, downloading the app, finding what's available and knowing that it's a different offering than a hotel. So like if people are going to, you know, Metro Savannah or San Diego or Dallas, they're still going to stay in the hotel. Like that's what's there. That's what's easy, especially, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, the hotels were easy to book. But now like Airbnb has made, you know, digital check-in with the use of technology so easy. You don't have to talk to anybody, right? You log onto your app, you find your place, you get a code, you go in. So now with like boutique hotels, you really adopt the pros of each with somewhat minimizing the cons of each. So like you get the standardization, the quality, the amenities of hotels with these bigger places because you can afford to spend on more amenities because you're spreading that cost over multiple units. You can have a full staff, a full cleaning staff, you know, maintenance staff as well. So your operations, your attention to detail, your guest service is better like it would be at a traditional hotel. But then you have the ease of bookability, you know, the online appeal, you know, self-check-in, mm-hmm. no contact. Those appeal of Airbnbs. So you really appeal to both demographics. And when you're a hotel, like you want to be like your goal is to get maximum listing distribution. And then over time, convert those OTA bookers into your direct bookings and like increase your percentage of direct bookings. But through that OTA listing distribution in the beginning, you're getting out there in front of all these people that hotels are seeing. So you're really be able to pull from a demographic of people who would book, you know, a short-term rental because they're seeing your listings and comparing the price and the quality and all these other factors to what else they're seeing on the platform and booking you there. And then you're going to people who would also book a hotel because of those standard or because of the qualities of hotels. So you kind of appeal and you market yourself to the whole market of people who are looking for a place to stay. And if you're in these high travel demand markets, like just by doing that, you absolutely crush. And a lot of times they're like the best deals are like generally value add hospitality deals, whether it's an older motel that you convert or a hotel that you're, you know, going to make into like a true boutique hotel or an old cabin community that had no online listing distribution. The easiest way to add value is on the operations piece, because that's how you're valued. So by just increasing the, you know, the top line revenue, managing it efficiently, you're getting a big increase in the NOI, driving the value of that property, and boom, you're making really good money on your equity split plus your cash flow, because you're having higher cash flow than, you know, renting it as an apartment or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes down to leveraging the technology that's out there, understanding what's out there. Oh, yeah. And then, like you said, it's value add in the business. And make no mistake, like listeners, when we're talking about this, just like in commercial real estate, and I would argue just like in any investment real estate that you're buying a business. And it's your job to pull the right levers to optimize that business to, like Blake said, increase your income, reduce your expenses, and overall increase your net operating income. And the cool thing specifically for me, like in commercial real estate, like a lot of the times you'll hear me or others in ADPI talk about like multifamily, large multifamily. Yes, you definitely have levers to pull. But just remember, in large multifamily, your tenants are what? They're yearly tenants. They're paying by the month, and they're in there for a year most times, right? Unless you got something weird going on. But in a hotel, you're doing daily rates, right? So much more variability. Now, what does that mean? That means a heck of a lot more operations, which might not be appealing if you're into the large multifamily space and you want to sign someone up on a year contract and not really talk to them. Yeah. That could be your thing, you know? And I talk to investors who swear by that. But in the hotel and hospitality space, we're talking daily operations. But the really cool thing is then when we start mixing in things like
daily events, revenue adjustments too. So you're not locked into month-long lease.
Seasonal,
so
you and can daily.
Adjust your revenue and manage rates daily, which increase your income as well. So
but also,
different side of the same coin.
But also events, weddings.
Yep.
Not just weddings, but like private parties, private events, things like that.
Yeah. Booking the whole hotel to, you know, a business group or, you know, I don't know, could be a traveling a hunter group. Like we have at one of the hotel members of my mastermind right now, like this hunting group from Missouri just booked this whole 18 unit, new hotel down in Arkansas. So it's like you get all these group bookings as well, to whereas you can't go find for most people on most budgets, you can't go find a house that sleeps like 30 people, right? Or 40 people or whatever, or have a wedding and be able to book everybody there too. But yeah, to your point, like you hit it right on the head. Like it is not the side hustle to get you financially free, like short-term rental investing can be, right? I think short-term rental investing, STRs, really easy to see an impact early, but that really easily becomes a new job or a second job really quickly. Like 1, 2, 3 STRs, you're cash flowing, you're making money, you feel like a genius. I know because I've been there. So if this is you, I'm not throwing stones. I've been in the same boat. And then 4, 5, 6, 7, you know, up to 10, 11, 12, you're like, holy shit, this is a lot of work. There's 10 guests all messaging me about the same thing. I've got to, you know, drop off new towels over here. The cleaner put stained sheets on the bed over here. So like all those things add up with the demand of more guests to take your time away from you running your business to enjoy the perks and the benefits of achieving financial freedom in the first place. But now with hotels, less of a side hustle to start, very much more of a business. You're buying a commercial, you know, piece of property. It's valued as a business. You need to treat it like a business, but has much more built-in inherent scalability, to where now you buy one hotel deal. It might take a little bit longer to find it, might take a little bit more work to set up the systems, but once it's up and running, it can be very, very hands-off. You've got your team in place. You've got systems in place. You've got, you know, VAs or an on-site manager, whoever, who handles all your guest issues and messaging. So you're really managing the people that are doing the day-to-day work. So that is where you get a lot more time back, and then becomes much easier to buy that second or that third hotel after that. Whereas like it's just as hard to buy each additional STR. But when you do that, your You know, if you go from 2 to 4, your demand doubles, but like you still don't have the revenue to hire the people that you need like you do with a hotel. So it's just a different game. And I think it really depends on what your goals might be. And a lot of people listening to this podcast might take this analogy a little bit better. Like the benefits you get from going from, you know, residential STRs up to hotels, boutique hotels, whatever, this commercial side of short-term rental investing is the same leverage that you get from going with single family homes or single family rentals up to multifamily investing. The economies of scale, the on-site management, more revenue, you know, you can have a, you know, your accounting team, your, you know, your VA, like you can hire and build and train your systems from one purchase. That's why a lot of the big multifamily investors, they don't look for 40, 50 unit places. They want multifamily apartments that are 70, 80 and above, so they can have on-site property management, a leasing staff, all this kind of stuff. The same is true. So STR to hotels, like just in your mind, like equate that with single family to multifamily, because the scalability is the same. It's just a different asset class, different operations.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. Yeah. I love that. I love that analogy. It's definitely true. Let's talk boutique hotels. The word boutique, it gives off a lot of different vibes. I asked my wife, who designs boutique hotels and she designs hotels for a living. I asked her what boutique means and she might give me a definition. I'm asking you, Blake, what does boutique mean to you?
I think really like the definition of it is smaller, independent hotels that aren't operated under a flag or a brand like Marriott, Hilton. So smaller, independent, and unique. Like those are the three kind of criteria. That's like your triangle of what boutique hotel investing is. So generally 50 units or under that are in good trendy destinations, like in good market, like areas within that market too, right? You're not going to buy on the, you know, the outskirts of, you know, Dallas. You're going to be like downtown in the Soho district or whatever, or, something like that. And that is unique and it's a design and its appeal and its amenities and the experience it provides guests. So like think of how that contrasts to a flag hotel or a branded hotel, you know, your Marriott, Hilton, Comfort Inn Suites, Holiday Inn Express. You go into every single one of those. They're exactly the same, very consistent, like not much, you know, pop or appeal. Like it's a little bland. A lot of them are, like not all flag hotels are, not even close, but those kind of provide the contrast to where boutique hotels are independent. They are, you know, operated as itself, maybe under a, you know, another portfolio of boutique hotels, but each one is, you know, independent, unique in its own right, and generally smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I'd agree with that. I think my wife would agree with that as well. And from a design factor, usually they're very much designed in line with where they're located. And
right.
they're geared like towards they have that aesthetic, but they're geared towards offering a very specific experience a lot of the times too.
Very much more focused on the experience as a whole. So I talk about that with my team all the time. Like, how do we create and cultivate the experience that guests have when they stay with us? And that goes into, you know, the decor we choose. That goes into, you know, the operational systems that we use when, you know, we have refund requests, or that when we have somebody to come check in, or when we have guests ask questions and how we respond to them, our tonality of how we approach guest relations. All these different things come into that guest experience. And that's, I think, much more intentional at these boutique hotels versus, you know, going, I don't know, stopping off I-70, you know, and staying at the Hampton Inn. You know, I'm not saying they have bad service or like ugly hotels, but it's just very, you know, vanilla.
Yeah. Yeah. You get what you get now. And now why is there an opportunity, or why do you think there's an opportunity in the boutique space versus why don't you just go buy a flagged hotel?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Honestly, I think if you're in the right markets and you're buying right, both work. I've got a friend of mine. He came and spoke to my mastermind a couple of weeks ago, who he's buying either independent or flag hotels that are underutilized, and he's going to get new agreements and renovating them, or new agreements with the brand, like with the Marriott or the Wyndham or the Hilton or whatever. And he's renovating them to their brand standards and then partners with an operator that operates within those same standards. So there's a lot more checks and balances. It's much more rigid. You have to follow the brand standards with, you know, the colors you use, the design and decor that you use, you know, the uniforms that you use, your PIP plans, your property improvement plans, of like how often you change out FFE, like how much you set back every month for your FFE reserve, which is your furniture, fixtures, equipment, the things that get used in the hotel rooms and wear out over time. So it's much more rigid, but they work. Like, and if you like that, then it's great. I think the unique opportunity in boutique hotels, especially for like STR investors making this transition up into the hotel space, like I did a couple years ago and with my first hotel deals, is that from that initial jump, like the operations are, yes, more robust, more detailed. You know, there's a lot more to it. You got to start to bring on people and kind of manage that process, but they are transferable. I think what you do in the STR space, if that's where you're at now, your skills do transfer to smaller hotel operations, you know, this boutique, right? 50 unit or less. Mm-hmm. And you can really be creative with it. And you might know things about your market. Like Kevin was saying, like the locale, the market, the area, you know, the street, the history of that place really plays into the design of these things. So if you can really fit your, you know, create something unique that fits your location and the guests that are coming there, what they expect and the experience that they think would be valuable when they visit your spot, then you're cooking with fire. Like, for example, like our ones in Panama City Beach, right? Very light, vibrant, bright colors, beachy, you know, do the best we can to get all the sand out of the floors because people always bring it from the beach. But outdoor spaces, right? They want to utilize the sun. They want to play in the pool. You know, they want to have outdoor games, all those things. So really we're very intentional about the design there. And then in Lake Tahoe, right? You have skiers, you have lake goers, you have mountain bikers and hikers. So you have more range. You can make it like a full-on lake vibe, which some of the hotels on the lake do. And if you're on the mountainside, you know, it could be more of the hiking, the, you know, dark greens, dark blues, mountain decor, things like that. And if you're closer to, you know, state line and heavenly, be more of the ski theme, have ski mm-hmm. racks, have decor that, you know, is, you know, snowy mountains or murals that are, you know, alpenglow, stuff like that. So it really plays in. And I think it gives you the opportunity to be creative, create something that's your own, and really stand out from the competition to charge as much as your market will allow. And mm-hmm. I think that's the cool piece, is not only do you get the creativity and the freedom to do it how you want, but I think on the back end, that translates into you being able to charge what you want as well, as long as your value meets the experience you're giving.
Yeah. And not to mention when you're in a flagged operation. So like, you know, just like using Airbnb, like if you solely use Airbnb for your short-term rental, you're paying a fee. Yeah. Like you're paying, it's marketing. You're paying a marketing firm to get you leads into your business and, you know, and all the things that they provide. And for that, you're paying, you know, upwards of 14%. When you have a flagged hotel, guess what? You know, Daddy Hilton needs his scratch. You know what I mean? Like he's going to be coming around.
Got gambling debts.
Yeah, Conrad. Yeah, Paris needs another Lambo or whatever she's doing.
Yeah,
but job or something. But the point is, you know, in the boutique space, it's you have more control. But you're also giving up, you know, that flag, that branded association, which
you're giving up the traffic for control.
Exactly.
So you're giving up the traffic for control. You know, create something that's unique enough that stands out, that gets views, then you don't really need the flag at all. So I think that's why a lot of operators go with the flag, because an established system, mm-hmm. you've got all the Hilton and Marriott card owners or like card holders that can use their points. They're loyal. They're going to stay at a Marriott every city, every location they go. So it helps you get more exposure, but it's the same kind of thing, like you're saying with Airbnb. But when you're a boutique, when you're independent, you have the control to drive your own marketing. Like I would much rather spend 8-10% on my marketing budget and be mostly all direct and not pay the 14-15% or 18% for like Expedia and those others that I'd have to pay the OTA, because then we're controlling all the guest information. We're controlling the follow-up sequences, controlling the email marketing. Like we can do text marketing because we're getting all this information direct. They're our customer. And it's much easier once they've paid us to stay with us that they come back and could become a repeat guest, stay at another one of our hotels or one of our vacation homes. Like Those are things that we want to do, is build our own brand so that in time, you know, it's more of like the Marriott effect.
I think there's a stat I read, Marriott, the company itself makes somewhere between $50,000 and $60,000 I think it's an hour or every half hour as a company.
Wow.
Yeah, it's something crazy.
You know, it's also funny. The only Marriott owns, I think, 2% of their hotels, and Hilton owns 1%.
Yeah.
So this asset light model as well, what you can also do in the boutique hotel space, like you don't have to just buy, or you don't even have to buy. Like you, if you have a management company, if you know short-term rental operations, whatever, if you find a tired owner, they don't want to sell. Okay, let me manage this thing for you. I'll do it a lot better, increase your revenue. And then you have your own version of the asset light model where you're able to arbitrage. Basically, it's like rental arbitrage, but on a commercial scale and much, very much more businessified, just like hotel investing is to STR investing. So
that's what I did with the arbitrage. I mean, that's how I got so many leads and run the Airbnbs and do all of that, because you're running a management company. Let's talk. Yeah. So that was a great breakdown on difference between boutique and flagged operations. Why is boutique, like, where are we finding these deals? Where is it a wealth transfer thing? Is it a heavy influence of mom and pop owners? Is it like where is this opportunity exactly in the space from your experience, and where do you see it going?
Oh man, really good question. I think I hate to take the cop out of it. It depends, but it kind of does on the market. I would say the predominant amount of deals that I've seen has been, like you mentioned, that transfer of wealth effect of, you know, these people are in their 50s, 60s, 70s. They've had these hotels for a long time. They're tired of operating them. Like, they're doing the bare minimum just to keep money coming in to pay the bills because they're just sick of it, right? FFE, the furniture, fixtures, and equipment in the rooms is worn out. They're old, they're outdated. There's deferred maintenance. They don't have, you know, some of them have direct booking websites, but they're not doing any marketing. They're not in the OTAs. So it's like, when I go and see that easy value add play just on the operations without like renovation yet. So they want to retire. So like 3 out of my 6 have been seller financed from those and from owners in that exact situation. The one I was talking about in the mastermind that just closed last month, that got like fully occupied with like under 30 days from buying it. Same situation. Old, outdated owner. And most of the deals that I'm seeing are these older owner operators that are, most of the time, all of mine but one, owner has lived on site, done mostly everything themselves, maybe has an employee or two. So like, and a lot of times it's a husband wife deal where like the wife's the housekeeper and like does front desk,
yikes,
husband's maintenance and, you know, whatever else around the property. So you could just go into that and seem like, hey, this isn't really, you know, operating as a business. These people are, you know,
they're
very self-employed. They're employees of their own operation. Like, they don't have the control of that. So if you can go in and be a problem solver to these people, and show them that there's a better way. Hey, if you sell your finance, I can still pay you every month. And guess what? You don't have to do any work. That's a really good option for a lot of people. So I think this asset class, more than any other, seller financing is so accessible, very much on the table. I've been in discussion with it with all my 6 deals, a lot in the mastermind as well, our seller finance deals. So I think that is something that we're going to continue to see. And with these baby boomers retiring, we're going to see the same thing. So I think as far as finding them, target those assets that have the potential, but aren't quite living up to it, right? They're in good locations, but they're run down. Like, the owner's the one working the front desk. If you call, it's the owner picking up, taking your reservation. Like, those are great ways to find deals and at least put yourself on their radar. Cause a lot of these people are stubborn, right? That's why I haven't sold the property or done anything else with it or made the improvements to the business. So create relationships, build rapport, show them how you can solve their problem and not just trying to like take their baby away from them. Cause a lot of times they're very personally invested in the deals. And it's all about relationships, as most of real estate is. But I think you can get into these conversations with sellers much, much easier than most other asset classes, for sure.
Hey guys, Kevin here. And I wanted to interrupt this week's podcast episode with just kind of a public service announcement. I don't know if you guys know this, but we have this thing called the cohort, and we have one for commercial real estate and one for residential real estate. But the cohorts
have been a smashing success as we launched them in 2023 and moving into 2024. We literally have like a wait list going right now. But if you're interested in learning how to do real estate investing alongside other like-minded, super focused people in the military community, like in our community, then you're going to want to sign up for the cohort. And the way we have it set up and that we're moving this direction with a residential cohort and a commercial cohort is the residential is going to focus on everything 1 to 4 units, whether that's buy and hold or BRRRR or short-term rentals and Airbnbs or like all of that stuff is in the residential side. And then your commercial real estate one, which is super powerful, is going to be focused on those large commercial 7-figure apartment buildings, mobile home parks, RV parks, things like that, that you thought you could never get involved in. But now with our brand new education on ADPI campus, which you guys know about, and combine that with our cohort and our coaches and everything coming together, it's becoming a very, very, very powerful tool. So if you're interested in getting involved with this, what you need to do is go into ADPI Campus, log into ADPI Campus. And if you don't have it, again, go to www.adpicampus.com, sign up for free. Go in there and check out the events and just make comments. Go in and make a comment and say like, hey, when's the next cohort starting? And we'll get you hooked up. It's that simple. And we'll get you on the wait list and where you need to be. So again, if you guys are interested in taking your real estate game to the next level, seriously consider joining one of ADPI's highly coveted and exclusive cohorts, either for residential or commercial. They're all awesome, and people are getting fantastic results. So hope to see you in one of those cohorts. And until then, we shall get back to the show.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can also, you'll learn that oftentimes, in the smaller businesses where like you're talking about, like where the owner is working the front desk and stuff, that's probably their only asset. But when you get into some more scaled operations, you'll see that, hey, the owner of this hotel, the reason that they're neglecting this hotel is because they have another cash cow asset that they've been developing over here. And maybe that's where they want to focus their time. So they're willing to give this one up to go over here.
And that was the situation with Fremont too.
Yeah, that was the Tennessee deal.
Close by, and this was the one that was just taking the, got the short end of the stick essentially, and didn't get any attention, didn't get the same level of quality, and it was just taking time away. And he's like, you know what, I want to focus on the one that's producing more money with less work. Like this one would take a lot of work. I know it has potential, but there's a slew of different reasons. They're too busy. I mean, you guys have been in the same position. Like, I'd love to take on something else, but I'm just too busy. The sellers of these hotels are the same way. So yeah. And then what's cool too, is like you make a good relationship with that seller. When it comes time for them to sell the next one, you're usually first in line, right? Mm-hmm. They've already know you. They've already worked with you. They've closed with you. They've seen you operate. Like, it's a great way to get deal number two pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk motels versus hotels. When people see
motel holiday.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be, that's going to be like your theme song at what is it? Your boutique con
coming
out. It's going to
be the intro. Like
Pitbull or whatever that. That's Pitbull.
Can we add that on here?
Yeah, we can. So tell me if this analogy is right. I'm sure the analogy, commercial real estate, mobile home parks, motels are to mobile home parks what multifamily is to standard hotel. Is that kind of like, do motels get the same like dirty vibe as mobile home parks? Or?
Yeah, I would not like strongly disagree, like, you'd never say that, but I don't think it just doesn't match up. Mm-hmm. So like hotels and motels, same asset class. The difference is that motels have exterior corridor and generally hotels have interior corridor. So motel comes from motor hotel. So like a lot of like they originated roadside, motels, people would drive up, get your key, go in your room, you stay for a night or two, you're on business or whatever, you load your stuff back up in the car right outside your door, you take off, go to the next place. So that is what motels are. Exterior corridor, like generally drive up type hotels. So hotels, interior corridor, parking lots, lobbies, that kind of stuff. So I would say most of the time, and I think this is where the generalization comes from, is that motels are usually like the older C-class properties, they are harder to finance because they are exterior corridor, meaning somebody can walk right up and, you know, theoretically break into a room and, you know, encroach on a guest safety. Whereas to do that in a hotel, generally you have to come through a lobby to get to the, you know, the hallway with the rooms. So that is the biggest difference. But I think like mobile home parks is a completely different asset class. Like you don't really own the real estate in the building. You just own the land and the utilities and put the mobile homes on top of them and rent them out, or they're owned by the tenants that pay lot rent. So you're really just a landlord of the land, renting out the space or the home, like the mobile home that can be pulled away. So motels though, I think are really cool first deal. And I kind of like call boutique hotels. When I say boutique hotels, I really mean like this overarching commercial asset of, you know, landscape resorts, hotels, motels, cabin communities, glamping, like the commercial side of short-term rental investing. So like a lot of times I'll refer to a motel as a boutique hotel. Mm-hmm. If it's been renovated, if it's nice and newer, if it's like fresh, and if it's like, you know, the painted brown on the outside with brown sheets and cracked black tile, like I'm going to continue to call that thing a motel, but there are technically the differences between hotels and motels.
So would you say then, Blake, with motels, as someone breaking into this, coming from short-term rentals to the, you know, generalized boutique hotel space, would you say that there are benefits to getting in as like a first deal on the motel versus hotel side?
Yeah, I would say so, like almost exclusively, because like generally hotels are going to be a little bit bigger, which means they're going to have a little bit higher purchase price, which means they're going to have a little bit higher barrier to entry for most people. Motels on the other side are a little bit cheaper, but still like can be in great locations. Like they can be on the beach, you know, in Panama City Beach, or right across from the beach where we had ours, on State Line in Tahoe, or, you know, in really good locations. So I think it's more about the real estate and the potential of the asset. And I think motels, I think, you know, as a boutique hotel can operate really well. You renovate it, you create the right design, you know, you freshen it up. If you do a really good job with it, people are going to love the, you know, the pop of it, you know, being eclectic and different, you know, and they will go stay in that just like they would a hotel and kind of treat it the same from a guest perspective with these, you know, shared spaces. So yeah, I think it's a great entry point for somebody looking to get into the space.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of applying it seems to me like that could be the space where if you have short-term rentals down and you have remote entry and you have your operations type figured out, it seems like the easiest transition where you
would, it's almost like STR light. They just share walls.
So yeah, I mean short-term rentals, it seems like, you know, it is, you said STR light, but it's like you're going to have, you know, the people, if you have your systems down, you have your, you know, remote entry and you have your operations down and all of that stuff, it's all going to transition well into a small kind of motel that could be great.
Yeah, absolutely. And like my first purchase, for example, like the first one we got live, because they're under renovation at the same time. The first one we got live was a motel, exterior corridor. It had parking, its own parking lot, and then you walk through to the exterior corridor. Still very much an older motel, built in the 60s, but did a full renovation on it. Looked really nice, very, you know, light, beachy vibe. But the size of it was 18 units. Mm-hmm. And they had the office that was the manager's unit, and then converted that to like the primo unit, or, you know, out of this property, right? Had the full size bathroom, a full kitchen, and a bedroom, living rooms, so like a full on large one bedroom apartment. So that unit can now be, instead of like, you know, you buy it, you don't need an on-site manager to live there because it is STR like. You just need somebody to like go in and visit. So you don't need somebody like working out of an office all day. You don't need front desk to check people in, because you can have the Schlage and Code smart locks that they get their code. So they park, go right up to their door, check in, they're good. They don't need front desk. So you can eliminate that as a labor expense. And then because you don't need that labor expense, you turn that manager's unit into a rentable unit. You add to your gross income, your expenses don't really go up, just like the incremental cleaning costs and like my new incremental utility costs. So you're basically adding that back to your NOI, increasing your value. So it's just, yeah, I mean, it's a huge thing that you don't need to run them like a full-on hotel. You can run them much more leaner and much more lean and have a great profit margin on these, you know, 10, 20, 30 unit deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And finding properties like this. Actually, would you want to do like a kind of a little BP-esque deal deep dive on this? I think our listeners would get a lot out of this, like this 18 unit.
Deal deep dive.
Let's deal deep dive. We don't have the, don't tell Brandon.
The submarine going down.
The submarine noise.
That's probably like copyright infringement. I don't know.
Yeah, probably. we'll talk to Brandon at ADP Icon.
Got a request.
So 18 units. You said this was your first motel. This is the Panama City Beach.
Yes. Purchased one. Just like background, I don't want to dilute it, but bought one in February of 2021 that was a full renovation. So this was like completely gutted at this time when I bought this one. This was June. So that one kind of started the momentum going towards boutique hotels. We bought this one that we're going to talk about in June and got it live first. So it's a better kind of one example that we started operating, hired the team,
Perfect. So you found this deal how?
Actually found it on LoopNet, right? Where deals go to die. And we got a mm-hmm. good deal there. But I would say look for value on LoopNet. Don't take everything on its face value. But the only pictures were like the property outlines from the property appraiser site. Like the basic what you see, the layout. Yeah. And it had like a two sentence description. I was like,
the broker put a lot of work into this listing.
Broker yet. Yeah. I'm still like so just perplexed at how that guy got paid. But I mean, you put it up there. Nothing the seller couldn't do himself. I'm like, it was the shittiest listing I've ever seen in my life. But I was like, hey, sweet lady, we got something here.
So, okay. So you found it on LoopNet and it was real crap. And then you obviously went to go investigate, reach out to the broker. You go, tour the property. It's in Panama City. You're in Panama City.
You know, this is how bad the broker was. He's like, I'm just going to give you the seller's information. You can talk about it with him.
I'll take my 6% commission though.
Just literally did nothing. But I think I found out why at the beginning, and you guys might encounter this too, because just like a kind of a different breed that owns these like older hotels and motels. Very difficult guy at the beginning to work with. Over the course of time, actually built a really good relationship with him. Ended up almost buying another hotel that he had in the area. He was that example of, the other one's the cash cow, doesn't really care about this one that much. Put whoever in there, if it pays the money, great. Didn't ever come to terms on the price for that other one. But yeah, when we were trying to figure it out, I was like, oh man, we are so different. This is like, he's in his 50s, old, established, he thinks he knows the world, right? And I'm, in my mid 20s, just figuring stuff out, trying to make it look like I know a thing or two, mm-hmm. right? Buying what is essentially like the first hotel we're going to get live. So just like completely different backgrounds and demographics, really hard to connect. We broke that down over time. But yeah, a lot of time spent out on the patio there trying to make the deal come to fruition.
Yeah, yeah. And funding this deal, how did that work?
So we tried the seller finance route because I knew he owned the other hotel. He didn't need cash right away, or at least so I thought, but he wanted to get rid of this to buy something else. I figured out through the negotiation process, he had his eyes on another property. So he was lining up a 1031 so he could take mm-hmm. whatever. Like, I think he bought it for like crazy cheap. So his basis is essentially what, by this time, what we bought it for.
Yeah.
Which is 1.1 million and this is 18 units. And when we went to get financing, couldn't do the seller financing, talked to a few local banks. And this is what you guys might find if you're trying to buy like large value add hotels, is that it's really hard to fund a value add hospitality asset where where the income, current income of the property when you purchase it does not service the debt of what your new loan will be, unless you already have a really good relationship with the bank, because they see those as riskier loans. So because of that, we went with a commercial hard money loan to get it purchased, went through a renovation. I might be jumping ahead, but
use like a bridge loan kind of a thing. And you got the bridge.
Basically a bridge loan. Yep. Renovated the property, got it stabilized, and then refinanced to get the equity out.
And how was refinancing then? Was that difficult knowing that, or was it better performing? Like, do they have
this one?
I guess my question is: do lenders and banks and stuff, do they have specific loan products for hotels versus like a multifamily or other commercial product out
generally
there?
Generally, it's the same loan product. I think one of the really good features that you have in the hospitality space is the USDA loan, which we're using on the Tremont deal. If you're in a rural area, which I found out through this process, is a lot more area than you would anticipate. Basically, any area outside of like the immediate metro area of like you know, the different cities across the country. So it actually covers a lot of things. It's not just super rural out in the middle of nowhere in Kansas. So that's one, the USDA loan. The other is the SBA loan. There's the SBA 7A and the, what's the one, 50-something?
Yeah, I can't remember right now. I want to say. Remember.
There's two different products of the SBA. It's just like the financing terms are a little bit different, but SBA, you can go research that, is another great option. So those would be like the dedicated products you could use for hospitality asset. But say you go to like a local credit union or a local bank, it's just going to be a commercial loan, you know, probably a 20 or a 25 year term, whatever the commercial interest rates are, probably 25% down. That's going to be pretty standard right now. If you're a stabilized property, now this one's a little bit unique because we refinanced before we were stabilized. So we actually did bridge to bridge so that we could get all of our equity out, return to investors, and then help use that cash to grow the company because we had another hotel deal working up. So that's what we did. We did bridge to bridge because we didn't get it fully stabilized. But generally, it's just a big BRRRR. Like, it's just a big, giant BRRRR property. And ideally, what you'd want to do is buy it, you know, with seller financing, bridge debt, whatever, renovate it, and then get it stabilized. So like 12 months of your like fully operational, you know, financials. And then go to a bank, then you're going to get your best financing terms with the local bank, credit union, SBA, USDA, whatever, and be able to get money out that way.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, in the multifamily space, they say, you know, it needs to be 90% occupied over 90 days, 90 over 90.
Right, yeah, that's the stabilization criteria for multifamily and hospitality. You really just want to have, really look at your, you know, your 12-month, your trailing 12 months of financials, and look at, you know, your income and expenses to determine your NOI, because that's what's going to, you know, your debt service is going to come out of the NOI. So to make sure that your NOI covers the debt of the new loan that they're giving you. As long as your T12 meets that, it's usually like a 1.25 or 1.3 for hospitality on a debt service coverage ratio, the DSCR ratio. So as long as you meet that over that trailing 12, you can get the refi, get money out, go do the next deal.
So
same BRRRR process you guys are probably familiar with, just on a bigger scale with another zero tacked on the end.
Yeah, there you go. Just another couple of zeros tacked on the end. So you bought this for $1.1 million. Looks like you had raised some capital to get that down payment. I'm sure you needed some sort of down payment, probably, I don't know, what, 10, 20%, something like that to bring to the table?
Ooh, that's a good question. I can't remember. No, it was 10%.
It was 10%. Yeah.
I think it was 20% loan to cost. So they provided, so like the difference of loan to value versus loan to cost is, you know, for the listeners, because I know you know this, Kevin, but like loan to value, if you're buying a $100,000 house or like this $1 million hotel, we'll say, then if you get a 80% loan to value, they're going to lend you $800,000 and the value is based off the purchase price. So now let's say, you know, we're going to do a loan to cost loan on that same $1 million purchase price, but now we have $500,000 in renovations. So if they're going to give us an 80% loan to cost loan, they're going to give us 80% of the $1.5 million.
Including the reno. Yeah, exactly. So yeah,
purchase plus reno. And sometimes they'll even do like working capital and, you know, different fees.
Because they want to do that because the interest rate is higher because they're making more money out of it.
Most of the time, as long as it meets their, like, you know, as long as you meet the down payment, like in the last year, I've seen it go up to 25 or 30% because they want less leverage on some of these deals. But yeah, they're generally good with loan to cost because, you know, that's why those loans exist and they're getting, you know, more interest on that bigger loan. So
yeah, no, 100%. So you get in, you get your bridge debt, you get this thing secured, then you were renovating all 18 units, right? I mean, this hotel was operating, I assume, poorly, and you came in and you're like, okay, we're shutting this thing down. Yeah. and you went and shut this thing down. And then what are we talking about? You got to hire designers, architects, like you got to hire a team, right?
Yeah, we did have to hire a team. This one we were trying to do really lean. And through this process, I was like, all right, more robust team. But my wife did the design on this one. She's not a licensed designer like your wife, but I think she did good enough, you know, good enough for government work. Something we all know here very well. But no, she did actually a really good job, especially like given the budget that we gave her. Like, she absolutely killed it with, like, I don't know, like $4,000 per room or something like that. I'm like, we're buying nice stuff like this so cheap. And yeah, we hired a W-2 property manager that was like our employee of the property management company. I think we waited until we got the second hotel in that market to hire the assistant manager. So we had the one W-2, we hired our cleaning staff, contracted maintenance, obviously our general contracting firm to do all the renovation. And then when it got time to furnish the units, it was me, myself, my wife, our property manager. And then I think we paid like some friends or like laborers that we knew, probably, I don't know, $1,500 total over those 2 weeks of the setup phase to help assemble all the furniture and put it in so we could meet our deadline to get live.
Wow. So you know, this is a project, and you get this project, it goes live, and you're I'm sure you're implementing different things. You're putting it on OTAs and booking.com and this and that and whatever. What happened?
So it went live in December of 2021. So not an amazing time to go live with a hotel or a short-term rental in the panhandle of Florida. But because this is low season, it just falls off. Like you make like 65 up to 70% of your revenue in that market in like May through the first week of August, in 3-4 months of the year. But we actually did pretty good because we went out on the OTAs. We had, you know, nice listings compared to the market. Everything was new. The pool in the cabana area looked great. We got it resodded. We just had this place looking really, really well. And it was so close to the beach, right? I mean, Panama City Beach, there's a ton of condos along the beach, but we're probably, you know, $20 cheaper than them. And those are all managed by property managers. So they have $60, $70, $100 cleaning fees for small little condos. We're paying our people W-2 hourly. So we had our cleaning fees low. So our total price looked a lot better. And that still allowed us to get really good margins. So we attract people in that way. And we did pretty well. I think us to like by March, we had reached our full absorption of our like anticipated occupancy rate. We obviously do like pretty good during like the holiday season, like New Year's. People come down to the beach, you know, people travel, you know, visit family, whatever. January and February are slow, but we probably stayed 40 to 50% occupied covering our costs. And then March hit and was like, boom, all right, we're on, baby.
Okay.
And then crushed it the rest of the high season.
And you still have this asset or is it still working for you?
This one sold last year.
Okay. So you do you mind sharing what you sold it for after you added all this value?
We sold them as a bulk package. I believe like on a split out basis, we bought it for 1.1 and sold it for like 1.95 or 2. Mm-hmm. So like 900,000, 850 or whatever in equity in 2 years, which wasn't great. Like we weren't fully like since we sold them as a package, one property wasn't fully stabilized, so that hurt the NOI. It was a partner split that caused the premature sell.
Sure.
So we left a lot of value on the table there, but you know, got out at the right time, and you know,
yeah, but you know, but moved on to the other asset.
Yeah, everybody and it rolled into Tremont, so everything worked out. So
yeah.
Like home run, but a solid freaking double. You know what I mean?
Made money. You're talking $900,000 in 2 years. Let's call it what it is. That's to listeners listening to this podcast right now. They're like, holy smokes, $900,000 in 2 years. Yes, it was a lot of work, but it speaks to economies of scale and going out and doing something different and finding something and creating something.
I also want to play into the naysayers. I also had partners and investors on that. So I like Blake, me didn't get to walk away with 900K.
Sure.
So you get like, that's the other thing, like good and bad, depending on how you look on it. Like I like bringing on investors. It allows you to scale and go bigger and give passive returns too. Like obviously if I don't know, grew up rich or whatever, hit it off on AMC or whatever when it went up during COVID. Yeah, on GameStop, I would love to just buy the hotel myself. But I really like partnering with the right people because it allows me to like, you know, you align yourself with these partnerships, allows you to go further faster. So yeah, that's my take on that. But it wasn't on me that made the 900.
Right. But you know, as far as, you know, creating the equity and making the business, I mean, it's really important for people to understand that those economies of scale. To be
made. And if we would have stabilized, I mean, we'd probably add another 700-800K on that on the portfolio. So it's like left a, you know, almost double if we would have
but
executed, you know, the full plan like we intended. But you know, sometimes partnerships go awry. So that's the other side of partnerships. I don't think I'll do another 50-50 one.
Yeah. You gotta make sure that you're with the right people. Business partnerships and marriage, man. This is really awesome, Blake. We've talked a lot a lot about boutique.
Yeah, we covered
hotels.
A lot of ground on this one, man. Yeah,
we covered a lot, man.
That's the hope we didn't get too in the weeds, but you know, I guess they got questions.
Maybe
hit you up.
Yeah, maybe I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of this. Normally, I would have taken to the bonus round, but we don't have any time for that because I want to talk to you about what you got going on. Tell me about, was it Boutique Con? Am I saying that right?
Boutique Hotel Con.
Boutique Hotel Con.
Which, what for those of you listening, as we've established, also includes Boutique Motel Con and Tiny, you know, Cabin Community Con, Landscape Resort Con. But no, this, I think we'll cover everything. They're super excited about it. It'll be at the hotel we purchased in December of last year in the Knoxville area in the Smoky Mountains. Freaking beautiful. We're doing it in the wedding and event venue there. We were laughing about this or whatever beforehand, but it's like, we can actually afford to have an event because I own the hotel and the venue, so I don't have to go pay for Marriott, you know, downtown residence in and whatever to host this event. So because of that, we can pass savings down to the attendees as well. But we're going to break down how to find hotels, how to operate, manage them, how to design them, all of the A to Z of how to really scale in the strategy. We're going to have some awesome speakers there. Like ticket prices will include staying at the resort as well. We're going to do a walkthrough of the hotel to show like all the things you've learned, how it actually comes to fruition. So you get to see a real world example in real time. So I think it'll just be a really, really cool way to do like the first ever conference.
Yeah. And this is your inaugural, like this is the first one. Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome, dude. Yeah. And what are the dates on that?
That's September 13th through the 15th. And okay. If you guys want to check it out, it's boutiquehotelcon.com.
Okay, boutiquehotelcon.com. The link to that is going to be in the show notes. And guys, guess what? As you probably already know, it does not interfere with ADPI Con in Denver, which is October 24th to the 26th. That is going to be fire. So put both of these cons on your calendar.
Yeah. Do some
con it. Just con it up.
Yeah.
All right, man. And then there's something else that you got going on. You mentioned a little bit about a mastermind and kind of a program that you run. Is that specific for kind of hoteliers and those people in the short-term rental space looking to make that kind of jump? What is that?
Yeah, exactly. Essentially, like I found this gap of like, man, I didn't know how to do everything on my first hotel deal. Like I had to learn it the hard way. And I've always had this like itch to scratch of like helping others to show them how to do this. Cause like some of my best growth has been through masterminds or connecting with new people or paying to be in a group. I'm like, man, how did I not know these people before? And like, you get like just scale so much faster. I was like, I want to like provide that to other people. There's not really anybody doing it in the boutique hotel space. There's really not many people doing boutique hotels at all. And really trying to kind of like establish that niche, because I think I'm seeing a lot more STR investors trying to make that shift just like I did, or having trouble finding deals or having trouble building their team or setting up their systems or, you know, whatever the missing piece might be for them. Or maybe they're just really like interested in hotels and haven't dug into that much yet and really want to learn how. So that's something I started last year. It's been an absolute blast because, as you guys can probably figure out, I can talk boutique hotels all day. So by getting to kind of use my insight and help people on their deals, like I'm learning more along the way. The whole community is helping each other. And like the group wisdom, I think, is growing a lot. So that's it's been really cool. It's been a really fulfilling experience so far. And
And it's kind of interesting to see, like we're talking about this evolution of short-term rental to the commercial side. And the interesting part about when you break into pretty much all assets of commercial real estate, there are some common things that you have to learn, especially if you are putting deals together with other investors. In the residential space.
Yeah, you got to know the building blocks before you take somebody else's money and try to learn it that way.
Exactly. And like, you know, in short-term rentals, you can do joint ventures and all of this stuff. You get an operating agreement, you start an LLC. Okay, that's pretty basic. You know, when you get into the commercial space and you're looking at $5, $6, $7, $8, $10, $20 million properties, unless you, like you said, Blake, are kind of just, you know, it struck it big with AMC or GameStop, like
the COVID gains, dude.
Yeah. The COVID gains. Then, you know, like, was that Eat the Rich, right? Unless you've been eating the rich, then you know that you've got to raise the capital, you got to syndicate the deal, you have to put those legal structures in place, you have to find a capital raise. Like, you got, there's a lot more to do in that space besides simply learning to operate the deals. So you have to see that you have to raise the capital, you got to bring it together, you got to get your legal entities in place, you got to get everything squared away to make sure that you're doing everything, you know, like I said, legally.
You got to be a prudent business owner.
Yeah, you got to be a prudent business owner, and you got to be a steward of your investors' money. So I think it's a genius move by you to bring both of those elements together and teach those elements to help people scale. I love that. Absolutely love it.
Yeah. And that's a big one we talk about too, is like they've done the stuff on the operation side of short-term rentals, right? They're comfortable of buying another 2, 3, 4 short-term rentals in a year, but uncomfortable or like unsure of how to go buy a hotel. And it's like, well, here's how we piece it together. What's the end goal? Oh, I want a 10 and 20 unit hotel. You know, depending on your market, it's probably going to be a $1 to $2 million property, maybe 2.5. So then what's the capital stack look like that? If you're going to be 25% down plus repair costs, and you're looking at $500K to $800K, do you have $500K to $800K? No, I've not really ever raised money. I've run some partners. Like, cool. Now we can work on your deal funnel because we know what you're looking for. Now we can work on your investor funnel and your capital raising. Because really, it's like, it's not a chicken and egg problem. You have to do both at the same time to be able to scale. You have to be able to find deals. You have to be able to find money. And putting those two things together to grow and scale in this space. And then you pair all like the, you know, robust operations and how me and my team work. Like, I license all of my systems to the mastermind members as well. So it's really a, you know, playbook of how to go get your own hotel deals and stand on your own 2 feet as a hotelier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or motelier, I guess.
Or motelier. Yes. we're going to start using that word. All right, Blake, man, this was super awesome. For folks who want to get in touch with you, maybe they want to, we already talked about Boutique Hotel Con. That's boutiquehotelcon.com. Obviously, search that after you buy your tickets for ADPI Con, obviously.
Yeah, do ADPI for it.
How could people get in touch with you?
Yeah, best place probably Instagram. So I'm on there at Blake J Daily. Daily is EY. So, I still answer all my DMs. Like, if you hit me up, I'd be more than happy to chat hotels with you, point you in the right direction, you know, put eyes on a deal for you if you think you found one and, you know, don't know quite what you're looking for yet. Try to help as much as I can. So feel free to shoot me a message.
Awesome. Hit him up in Instagram. Get into Blake's DMs. Learn about this space, guys. Baby. There is a wave coming. There is a massive wealth transfer coming. We're on the precipice of it.
Absolutely.
And there are a lot of these opportunities that are out there that you may not think you can get into, and you absolutely can. So make it happen. And Blake, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me on, brother.
Another amazing episode in the books. Thanks so much to our special guest, and thank you for listening. Don't forget to tap the subscribe button now to make sure you don't miss an episode. Or head over to our website at www.activedutypassiveincome.com to grab all of our free resources and discover how you can get started on your financial freedom journey today.